everything. Oh my God, I love everything. So many everythings to learn in 2023.
Beautiful.
A whole nother year of learning.
Ah, amazing.
My parents are going to bed, so I can't yell. I just do excitement in a really weird, squeaky voice instead.
Oh, I read it as a very, like, hell speak, like, everything. We will learn everything.
Yeah, I realised it was coming out like a demon sound and I just ran with it.
A little bit.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything everything interesting. That's how I introduce myself when I'm doing shows at work. It's just hello, 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 everybody. And it's bleeding through. I'm so sorry. welcome to 2023.
Woo!
It will be 2023 when you listen to this. It's not 2023 when we're recording this.
It is. We know all the news events that have happened since then. Like,
can you believe that we've had another prime minister in the UK, our fourth in 6 months? I can believe it.
Oh yeah, oh 100%.
Oh, and Twitter's collapse and Elon Musk trying to take over the world.
Elon Musk bought Tumblr. Oh, what a wild handful of reasons.
And he reinstated porn, but it's all porn about the film Cars. You know, the Disney film. It's really weird.
Yeah, I mean, it is what happened on our agreed upon definite real universe, not something we need to talk about after. Oh boy.
As you can tell, it's the end of the year.
No, it's not the end of the year, Carol.
I know. I'm gonna edit that. So it's like, and as we all know, it's the start of the year, and we're all excited.
My name is Caroline, and this episode's main topic is going to be why fixing the ozone was a miracle. We're chatting about the ozone layer. Yay. Finally,
I thought you were gonna say a mistake. Burn humankind.
So hold on, I don't want to spoil. Is this like a good story?
It's cute up until a point, and then we're going to talk about the relation to current affairs, which might be a bit sad.
Sure, sure, sure.
But it's important to talk about it. So yeah, it's gonna be a fun one.
That's exciting.
Climate change, fun.
Woo!
My name's Tom, and today's question is: why and how can owls turn their head around, and what other animals can too?
Nice. Okay, that's fun. Love that.
Today it's going to be an extremely question-y question. We're going to be pulling on that thread. Again, we're asking why, how, what. And of course, because we're talking about owls, we're going to be asking who.
Ooh. Ooh. Ooh.
I knew it, but...
I knew it, but I still enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I didn't. I did. I'm kidding. Okay, my name's Ella, and today's miscellaneous topic is about one of my favourite things in the world, to be honest. It's about the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yay!
Oh, I'm so excited!
Oh, I'm excited!
I love Eurovision.
I've heard murmurations of your excitement over the past as long as I've known you, so I'm very excited to.
Yeah.
Again, as an American, know basically nothing. I know countries sing songs, and so I'm really excited to learn. Amazing.
Amazing. All right. Shall we dive in to our first topic today?
Woo!
We must.
We must.
I'm sorry, I don't know why I said it like that. I'm excited. Go.
Thank you. There we go.
Oh, God.
So we're going to be talking about why fixing the ozone was a miracle. We're going to start from the very, very beginning because I feel like we all know that the ozone exists and that it's important, but how much do we actually know about it? I wasn't 100% sure, so I'm going to ask you both a question. Can you tell me what the ozone layer is?
No, no, come on, ask me to spell it.
Ozone is a gas, O3.
Yeah.
Which is...
Oh God, I'm so fucking stupid.
Caused by a photochemical reaction by the sun breaking up oxygen and water in the atmosphere. And the two oxygens and the one oxygen combine and form O3, which is ozone. And that is, like, I don't know what properties of that, but it forms a layer around the Earth that protects from ultraviolet radiation.
I was going to ask, do you know this from cosmic rays? Or did you just know this already?
I know this from writing a different side topic. Let me actually tell you about this because it's really interesting. Really quickly. So these, I think it's called a photochemical reaction, where basically a star causes gases in the atmosphere to break up and reform as different gases. Using the James Webb Space Telescope has data that shows there is one of these reactions going on an exoplanet. It's not forming ozone, but it's forming something else.
Oh.
And they basically think that this is like an indication of how exoplanets could be made habitable, which is really cool.
Interesting. Huh.
You know what I'm imagining? I'm imagining, like, if something is like a food item is like covered in sugar, you get this like caramelized layer. I'm imagining like the heat from the sun causes this like outer gases to like form, not like almost like a crust in some ways around it. I will fully admit, my brain was like, maybe ozone stands for oxygen zone. It's the zone.
Well,
where
you're
oxygen
not. I mean,
is.
You're not wrong.
Wrong.
You're not right, but you're not wrong.
So ozone is a gas. It's O3. It's three oxygens. I'm trying to re-explain it so I can digest it myself. And it's made in the atmosphere because of all of the sun's rays hitting those gases and turning them into ozone, correct?
Pretty much. So ozone is in the stratosphere. The stratosphere is like the layered atmosphere above our heads. So the ozone layer is about 9 to 18 miles or 15 to 30 kilometers above Earth's surface. So that's where the ozone layer is. And it consists of three oxygen molecules bonded together.
Did you say 9 to 18 miles?
Yeah, 9 to 18 miles or 15 to 30 kilometers.
So it's like a chunk.
It's a big chunk of the stratosphere, yeah.
I know that probably won't affect it, you know, in the end. I'm sure like it doesn't change anything, but it does change my perception. Because when you talk about like chemicals, I'm picturing like a thin like bubble film.
Yeah,
but I always
yeah.
forget that, like, I don't know, like gas is like a liquid. It's a huge layer. That's wild.
Yeah. It's chunky, that's for sure. And I did not realize I'm not wrong.
Well, and also, you know, when you talk about like breaking like a hole in the ozone layer, you think like, I don't know, like it's like a tear in like a bubbles film or something.
Yeah, totally. You think of it as ripping apart. Whereas when you think about how thick it is, like that hole in the ozone isn't necessarily like the ozone is just gone, but it's thinning out quite a lot that space. Mm. Yeah, which is,
I have
that imagery in your head of like literally like a hole there, and that's not quite how it works.
Is the fact that there's just so much of it is what protects us from UV?
Yeah, totally.
Because it's just like miles and miles of this one molecule piled on top of each other.
Literally miles and miles, yeah.
The one other thing that I wanted to mention was that the ozone layer isn't just molecules of ozone. So it's not just molecules of O3.
Right.
For every one ozone, so for every one molecule of O3, there may be 10 million other molecules of something else.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not just like this dense.
Again, very helpful to,
Yeah. So what does the ozone do for us is my next little question for you.
I mean, it probably does other things, but it protects us from ultraviolet radiation.
Yeah, absolutely. It protects us from harmful radiation from the sun, specifically UVB, which can penetrate the top layers of our skin, can cause mutations in our DNA, cause melanomas and other types of cancers. So the ozone, among other things, protects us from UVB. Regarding the mechanism for this protection, ozone, or O3, is constantly being broken down into O2 and then made up again in the ozone layer. It's not always like stable. Sometimes it's broken down, then sometimes it gets made back up again. That's what we were talking about earlier with that like photochemical reaction and all of that jazz.
Yeah, that's wild.
So UVB radiation enters the ozone layer, and the energy from this UVB radiation is converted into thermal energy. So it goes from radiation to heat energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this heat is what is breaking down the O3 bond into O2.
Okay.
Got it.
Yeah. O2 is also being photolyzed by the sun. So that O2 is becoming an O1. So some of those O2 molecules are becoming O1 molecules, and then they all bond back together again.
They're like molecular shock absorbers, basically. Yeah. Like they take the photon and then they wiggle it all out and into this big old space.
Yeah, totally. So that UVB comes in, it changes, it turns into heat. That heat does stuff to the ozone layer.
Got it.
And then it gets made back up again. And it just sort of remains, yeah.
I don't know if you know this, or I don't know if either of you happen to know this offhand. Is the ozone like the... I don't know why. Like, when I think of, like, the atmosphere as, like, this, like, thin shield protecting us, is, like, the ozone, like, the big thing that protects us from radiation?
Have you ever seen, who's that YouTuber? The Sun is a Deadly Laser.
The sun is a deadly laser.
Oh, yeah. Bill Wirtz.
Bill Wirtz, that video.
Yeah.
That's literally like, that's what, that's how we got out of the ocean. That's how the...
Holy moly.
Because it allowed land creatures to be protected from the sun, which they weren't before. So they used the sea.
What on earth?
This is really so boggling Tom's brain.
I know.
And I
feel so stupid, but also now I feel so smart. I don't know. I guess I've just never, we hear about it in such, you know, and maybe this is background that I'm sure all of us know, but maybe not all the listeners know, that like the fear of the ozone deteriorating was such a like ecological and like almost like political talking point.
Yeah,
but I feel
totally.
Like we so rarely talked about it from a like this is interesting perspective, like a physical or chemical or even like evolutionary perspective. So I feel stupid because like I've heard this a million times, but I also feel smart because I'm now like hearing it in a different context for like the first time, which is wild. Yeah.
I guess that's you're making a very interesting point there, Tom.
So we're talking about the hole in the ozone layer. Do you guys know when that hole or that thinning was discovered? Do you know what year it was discovered in?
Huh. I want to say 90s. Like the 90s. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
1990, like five.
So it was actually initially discovered in 1977.
Okay.
Okay, that's pretty early. But then again, we know that oil companies have known about global warming or climate change for
that
like 50 years.
A long time. So. Yeah. So the story around how the hole in the ozone was discovered is kind of interesting. So I want to talk about it. So in 1977, Jonathan Shanklin gets a job at the British Arctic Survey, with one of his first jobs being to check and correct all data collected from the Dobson Ozone Spectrophotometer. That was a word. So this spectrophotometer, even.
Photometer.
Photometer. The Dobson Ozone Spectrophotometer is in Antarctica.
Say that three times fast.
The DOSP.
I don't know if I can today.
Dobson Ozone Spectrophotometer, Dobson Ozone Spectrophotometer, Dobson Ozone Spectrophotometer.
I'm so impressed.
Thank you. That's actually quite hard.
So, this piece of kit is used to detect the amount of UV reaching the Earth, and in turn is a very important piece of kit for accurately reading how much ozone is in the atmosphere. If more UV is reaching Earth, there's less ozone in the atmosphere. So, the British Antarctic Survey also wanted to host an event in Cambridge, where they essentially showcased, read, show off their research.
Mm-hmm.
So Shanklin thought he could present some data from the Dobson Ozone Spectrophotometer. Nailed it that time.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nice. Gonna use that clip in all the previous ones.
Oh, yes. So Shanklin later said about this event that there had been concern at the time that exhaust gases from Concorde, the supersonic passenger aircraft, or chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, from spray cans might damage the ozone layer. Being an ignorant physicist, I thought this unlikely, so decided to present that year's data and compare it with values my boss had computed from a decade earlier.
Wait, was that him? Is that him owning himself, a self-diss?
Literally,
okay,
yeah.
Just wanted to double check.
He is, yeah, he's literally like, I was an ignorant man. I was just like, it's going to be fine.
Physicists are allowed to say that about themselves. Yeah, and maybe other maybe other fields also, but definitely physicists can self-publish. Yeah.
So, I'm going to say that last sentence again.
Yes, please.
Being an ignorant physicist, I thought this unlikely, so decided to present that year's data and compare it with values my boss had computed from a decade earlier. I expected them to be the same, so Concorde would be able to keep flying and the public could keep using their spray cans. He was wrong.
Well, glad you checked.
Oh, spray cans! I completely forgot that aerosol, deodorant was a huge issue for ages.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was wrong. The ozone was depleting in the study area that he used, and he went on to say, I thought it was something that was perhaps peculiar in Antarctica and only of scientific interest.
These are amazing quotes, by the way. I've never heard... I find these so interesting. I feel like we... It's just very interesting to have been the person to have noticed this and been like,
right?
Oh boy. Ooh.
Yeah, it's like a well understood and very well known phenomenon now. Mm-hmm. But I guess it had to start somewhere.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And it just happened to be this guy who had just started a new job, basically, and was like, oop, messing about.
It's simultaneously also just like regular ass science. Like, it's like, this this is why we monitor things, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's so funny.
Not
to hear
even
these.
That, but
these
like regular scientists who do what so many scientists have to do, and that is show off the stuff that they're doing in order to get funding or to do all of these things. And by doing that, he accidentally found the proof of this thing happening. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting to me. So this was discovered in 1977. His findings were published in 1985. And this was the first paper published to fully detail the decline in the ozone. It's titled Large Losses of Total Ozone in Antarctica Revealed Seasonal... Blah, 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 blah. It continues. I'm not going to say the whole title of the paper. It's by J.C. Farman, B.G. Gardiner, and J.D. Shanklin. A link will be in the show notes, but this... like monumental paper is now behind a paywall, which I love.
Sci-Hub.
Yeah. Sci-Hub.
That's where I found the paper. Yeah. Apparently I literally wrote a note in here being like, I don't know what to tell you. I was frustrated with the world of science whilst writing this script. I wrote this script like 2 months ago. And I love Past Caroline for leaving that little note in there. Just... thank you, Past Caroline.
You're like, let me have this, future me.
Yeah. So my next question for both of you, which I think we've covered a little bit on, is what was causing the hole or the thinning of the ozone in certain areas?
Yeah, can I be honest? Now that I think of it as this miles-long chunk that is also like very disparate, I guess maybe that's the aspect that makes me think it's possible to like... thin it. Oh, and then I get So it's less of like a hole in a film. It's more of like a thinning of a cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so okay. Now I can rock it in my mind. Like I can see how it can. Break.
I feel like we've said this in so many different ways now. So hopefully everyone listening will understand.
Yeah. No, we'll get like three more metaphors. It's sort of like a sock on a foot. It's like the meat around the scotch egg.
It's like when your toe... it's like when your toe is like... your big toe is slowly pushing through the end of the sock and it's starting to thin, but the toe's not gone through yet.
Oh, I like that
one. It's like a thick wool sock. It's like a really... And the sock is like... 5% polyester, and that represents the ozone... or I guess it's like 0.01% polyester that represents the ozone. Wow. I love understanding things. Metaphors are great.
I love that for you, Tom.
What was the question? What was causing this? So yeah, I think to Ella's point, I remember aerosol being like a big thing, which I guess is just like another gas that maybe changes the makeup, and so that these shock absorbers for the sun's rays aren't there anymore, or they function differently, or like they break down differently. You know, I'm almost imagining no, I'm tired of metaphors. It's that.
Ella, do you know what was causing the hole in the ozone layer? I feel like you might have this knowledge. in your head?
I don't know that. I don't know the chemistry of it. No, I remember. Yeah, cool. I remember aerosol deodorants being a problem, but I don't know why.
Yeah. So the specific chemicals are CFCs, which are chlorofluorocarbons.
I have heard of this.
And chlorofluorocarbons. HCFCs, which are hydrochlorofluorocarbons. So CFCs and HCFCs.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the long name for them every time.
No, of course not.
So they are the bad guys here. And we actually, like, had a theory that they were causing us issues all the way back in the early 1970s.
Really?
Yeah. Earlier than you might expect, with people like Melina and Roland producing a paper in 1974, literally talking about how chlorofluorocarbons and chlorofluoromethanes could cause destruction to the ozone. We obviously didn't have specific research to back it up at that point, but this theory was there. So CFCs and HCFCs at the time were thought to be stable in our atmosphere.
Mm.
So at the time, we thought that they were environmentally sound chemicals to be using in things like aerosols, like we've spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
They were then later on used in literally everything from refrigerators to fire extinguishers. We used these chemicals everywhere because we thought that they were safe to use in our atmosphere, basically. As they travel up that stratosphere, as they travel up into the ozone, UV radiation once again causes the CFCs and the HCFCs to break down. Much like it did in the ozone for O3, causing that to break down, it causes these things to break down, releasing chlorine into the ozone layer. Mm. This chlorine causes the ozone molecules to be broken down and then bonding with the chlorine. And then basically meaning that these oxygen molecules are being taken away and then not being used to replenish the ozone supply in the atmosphere.
Got it.
So basically, CFCs, HCFCs, absolutely fine at ground level. As soon as it goes up, it takes away the oxygen.
I'm just once again amazed at the scale of human activity that we are able to cause this.
And
much.
So quickly as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Humbling.
So the events of 1985 with that paper being published by Shanklin and his colleagues confirmed basically what everybody was worried about, that CFCs and HCFCs were definitely causing this thinning and was definitely, the UVB was going to get through, it was going to cause a bunch of skin cancer in people, people were going to be seriously impacted by this. And of course, that meant that we immediately put laws into place to prevent this from happening any further. We banned the use of CFCs. We saved the day. It was as easy as that, folks. End of the story.
Wow, what a good topic, Caroline. Thank you so much.
I'm so sorry.
What's your question, Tom?
Let's do a big hip hip hurrah for humanity. Hip hip hurrah.
We don't talk about law stuff very often. And I want to like dip my toe into international environmental law.
Because
I did a little bit of this for my master's.
Oh, amazing.
That's where I got this topic from, ish.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a bit more about what went down specifically. Because some countries were super on board with like reducing the amount of CFCs that we used.
Yeah.
Some of them were less down. And I don't think it's going to shock you which countries were less down, but I want to talk about it anyway. So, several countries, including America, Canada, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, were all for banning the use of CFCs in aerosols specifically. Go, Tom! America actually did it for once.
Yeah, well done, Tom, for solely making that decision on behalf of your country.
So proud of you, honestly.
Thanks, guys.
The Netherlands, which was a major producer of CFCs, as well as a major user of CFCs, this country required warning labels on aerosol spray cans as well, which is quite a big step considering.
What would the warning label say? Warning, you are destroying the environment.
Will cause skin cancer in 50 years, yeah. May cause major death for all future humans.
Yeah.
West Germany, which is another large producer and user
It was just a picture of like a toe sticking through a big sock, because we all know that metaphor. So I got on all the cans.
For fuck's sake.
West Germany, so this was in the 90s or the 80s or 90s then?
The 80s and 90s, this was all going down.
But I remember this still being an issue when I was growing up. So
yeah, so
it didn't. happen very quickly.
No, it didn't happen very quickly.
Legal proceedings weren't protracted and drawn out.
Can you imagine, like, all of the major nations working together to do something in any timely manner? Wow.
Wait, but Caroline, there was scientific consensus and agreement. What could possibly have interfered with capitalism?
I'm surprised that the UK hadn't put more laws in place by the time I was already a teenager.
So,
are we going to get into that? Oh, boy.
Oh, good. We're one of the countries that didn't do it. Good. I love that.
Now, can I ask? Caroline has the biggest smile. Caroline, can I ask? Can I ask if you know offhand, like, where do CFCs and HCFCs come from? Do they come from, like, fossil fuels or, like, natural gases or, like?
They're not. They're man-made. They're man-made. They're not they're natural.
They're
man-made.
They're, like, the gas of plastics.
They're the plastics of gas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Basically, they are produced by humans. They are not found naturally. It involves replacing hydrogen with various chemicals.
Yeah, I was just surprised that the Netherlands were such a big producer of it. That was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. The Netherlands and West Germany were really big producers at the time of it. Speaking of West Germany, the industry there agreed to a 1/3 reduction in CFC use in aerosols, which is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There were also concerns that the development of supersonic flight would also lead to ozone depletion. The states, specifically the United States, put a hold on their plans to develop commercial supersonic transport because of this research that was coming out, basically, which, again, is a huge positive step in the right direction reducing
that's
this.
That's great, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Britain and France, though.
When you said the countries you'd expect it in, the countries you didn't expect
now they
it, why?
Often, Britain and France and members of the EU often use a lead by example sort of method for trying to implement international law.
I say this, but the UK has just decided to open its first coal mine in like 20 years, so.
Ooh. Yep. Yeah.
So that's cool.
That's fun. That's so cool.
Fuck the Tories.
Britain and France not having it. They suggested that the United States was being motivated by economic concerns. They were worried that there would be European dominance in commercial supersonic flight, in theory. And they thought that these were like economic concerns over any actual environmental concerns.
Supersonic flight. Yeah, because we're all just busting around in supersonic aircraft right now.
Right? Yeah.
Wait, so they're like, this is our chance. Everyone's going to make it illegal and we're going to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. That's our business plan.
Yeah, then we won't be able to fly to any of the other countries because they won't allow it. We can just zoom up and down between France and the UK. Woo!
That's right. We're the only countries piloting the Super Coal 10,000 bird with a coal plant on the plane.
So Britain and France went as far as to say that this is a form of environmental neocolonialism.
Ooh.
Which is essentially using environmental policies to try and control another country or countries.
You're doing colonialism on us.
Yeah.
And we would know what colonialism is.
Past Caroline in this script literally wrote, pretty rich of Britain and France, not going to lie, obviously not what was happening. And I love Past Me again for writing that down. So a more precise definition of environmental neocolonialism is the extension of colonial practices through the exertion of economic, political, cultural pressures to control or influence previously colonized nations.
Mm.
Obviously, does not really apply to England in that case.
No.
So, again, really, really rich of them to be saying this stuff. Eventually, Britain and France did abandon their supersonic transport development and also eventually signed up with the rest of the European Economic Community to reduce aerosol use of CFCs by 30%. So, eventually, all of Europe was like, okay, fine, we'll reduce this down. They gave in to international pressure and they did the thing.
Just agree with everyone. Instead of having to fucking walk it back, it's so embarrassing. Just go with it.
Yeah. These policies, however, ignored other molecules that led to ozone depletion. These specifically focused on CFCs. They didn't really look at HCFCs,
okay,
which is the worst version of CFCs. Basically, there's a long way to go in this journey. I am going to skip forward to a little bit because, like, it is really, really positive. We do eventually get there. We sign the Vienna Convention for the Protection of the Ozone Layer, which this was brought into effect in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, this piece of legislation didn't take too long to get sent through. This legislation doesn't really mean anything. I mean, it is not forcing the countries that have signed up to it to do anything about it. They've just all sort of agreed to, they're like, yeah, buddy, we'll do it, it's fine. This convention also provided a bit of a backbone for a more famous piece of international law called the Montreal Protocol.
I have heard of this.
Yeah. It's super, super famous. This was signed in 1987. A lot of countries that were involved in the United Nations at the time signed this protocol. That's 198 different parties signing this protocol.
Wow. That rules.
And the even more wild thing is that all 198 parties then wrote this into their own law, meaning that they actually did have to do something about it rather than it just being like a little piece of paper actually means something. And this is essentially was what led to it being universally accepted that a lot of countries should reduce their CFCs use. It was amazing. It was really, really good. And we are slowly but surely fixing the hole in the ozone.
So it's actually filling up.
It is. So it's taken a bit of time to stop the CFCs and the HCFCs that were in the ozone from doing their thing. So it's not, I think it has just started to actually fill up again, but it took a really, really long time to stop it from doing bad things.
This is a really good example of international collaboration actually having an effect on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of like doomerism about approaching climate change. And scientists have a lot to do with that as well. Like this idea of it's already too late. And like people feeling like it's pointless trying because there's nothing you can do. But it shows like it does take time. Like it's, you know,
totally.
It's been 30 years, whatever, and we're only seeing good effects like it in really improving now or, you know, and recently. Mm-hmm. And I think people like just don't lack the foresight for that 30 years in the future. It just shows if we start making big steps now, and that was a big step, nothing. Let's get rid of all of the CFCs. Let's not. You know, I mean, I know it was only part of what we need to do, but it was a big step.
Yeah, totally.
And it just goes to show that, like, it's a good tale for...
This is the thing. It's such a good tale. And it's the only tale of its kind when it comes to implementing international environmental law in this way.
Shit.
We've never done it before. We've not successfully done it again yet.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that we won't be able to, but I think it's a really important story to tell of like 198 different nations actually implemented something that they promised that they would implement at one of these environmental committee things that they all of these important people go and take a plane to and they sign that bit of paper, you know.
And they were able to like convince countries that had changed their mind, like Britain and France were able to hop on, like
that's absolutely
probably gonna end up having to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm. It also goes to show how important immediate action is, like
the thing about
a lot of America, Britain, a lot of these kind of European countries and their climate change goals are like, okay, we'll stop doing this one thing by 2050 or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not enough. Like that. It's just not enough. It has to be sooner. It has to be more immediate.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing the reason why this was so possible is because the technology that we used for things like refrigerators, things that use CFCs, was replaceable in a reasonably easy way.
Yeah.
And that's why it's not the same.
And it was such a specific thing as well. Like it was CFCs and HCFCs that very specifically did it. And obviously we found them in a lot of places, but we knew that that specifically was what it was.
Mm.
And we could then work to reduce the use of that chemical in a variety of ways. Technology was improving so rapidly at the time as well that we were creating stuff that could replace these things and be more efficient.
Yeah, I think that just again reinforces the idea of the importance of acting quickly, because like if we had found this out maybe like 30, 50 years later, and we have this industry now entirely reliant on it, maybe yeah. it would have been so much harder, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I will say, I think that is a very important caveat to this story, but I do also think it's still a great win, and it's a shame we don't talk about the win enough, right? Mm. Like, this right. is a, this should be so... a model, or like a thing that we point to be like, let's do one of those again.
Yeah, I do agree.
It's so interesting that you would mention that, Tom, because
uh-huh.
the reason that I wrote this script
uh-huh.
several months ago was, at the time, a very big account on Twitter had tweeted something a little bit silly, which was essentially along the lines of, why don't we talk about the hole in the ozone anymore? Isn't that like a really, really important thing that we should be talking about? Or does that mean that like environmentalists are just making it up for clout? Was essentially the gist
who
of this
said that?
Tweet.
Oh my God.
I can't remember who the Twitter user was. I didn't write it down at the time.
That's fucking, I remember seeing this tweet. And
do you remember this tweet? Yeah.
I do.
That's so funny.
Oh, that's a shame. That sucks. Yeah.
Obviously, that person is dumb for not checking, but it kind yeah. of is a
no,
bad
also,
sign
yeah.
for scientists and like environmental activists, and that this wasn't made.
The messaging.
Yeah.
The message
yeah.
wasn't put out to the public that we did this thing and it made change.
Mm-hmm. It had such a positive impact, and so many, like, I don't want to undersell how amazing it is that so many different countries actually yeah. worked together on something
yeah yeah
in a way that has never been seen before. Yeah,
classic scientists, they're not very good at communicating their science to the public.
Ah, yeah, awful.
It's why we're here, we're doing their job.
Yeah, so I just wanted to be like, just answering that little tweet, because that really annoyed me at the time, is actually because, according to the United Nations, around 99% of ozone-depleting substances have been phased out and the ozone is finally replenishing. That's why we're not talking about it so much.
That's really
but
good.
We should be.
That's so, yeah, yeah. That's
listeners,
such a shame. That
spread
hurts.
This news to your friends and family. The ozone is coming back, and it's because
and
we took
it.
Environmental action.
Yes.
Thank your local environmental researcher today.
They deserve some praise. They're probably yeah. like hiding in a terrible office somewhere writing a paper. Go and, yeah. go and give them a chocolate.
Receiving little to no money.
Yeah, yeah.
Watching these meters and devices and graphing things all day.
So the point that I wanted to leave this on is still a very important thing to mention. Why are we struggling to do that again? Mm-hmm. Why are we struggling to work together so much? We all did it once, where we all ratified things into law and we all came together. Can you guys think of any reasons why we might be struggling again to do that?
Because it's because there's no easy answer now, because
it's not easy. Absolutely.
Countries are moving at different in yeah. rates yep. of industrialization, yep. which means they have
absolutely,
different benefits
yeah.
for stopping mm-hmm. or not stopping. Like, people who are like, who have more social stability have more room, like countries that yeah. have more social stability have more room to care mm. about mm. the things like the environment, and countries that don't, right? It's mm. like, there's so many reasons.
Of course, there's so many financial incentives against all of these things,
yeah,
because
yeah.
all mm-hmm. these problems are so long-term.
Also, yeah, capitalism.
Yeah, that's yeah. the answer.
The other one that I wanted to kind of mention is that, like, we're trying, and we're just not doing very well at it. So one of those is the Paris Agreement, which I assume
right.
you both have heard of as well.
Yes, because the one that Trump unsigned and then Biden yeah. signed again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just such a shame, because I feel like now the common consensus about these people think about the Paris Accords and how it has become such a mess. And that is,
yeah.
that's sort of like the modern poster child of conservation agreements.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And on the Western side of it, particularly America, this is another issue for pushing through these kinds of agreements, is the political like landscape where
yeah,
climate,
totally.
Where you can use climate change as like a political football.
Mm-hmm. And a change in political leader can very quickly change how a country responds to these sorts of things. Mm. We saw it with Trump. We are seeing it with what's happening in the UK right now. It takes very, very little in the grand scheme of things to get a country to sign an agreement or for a country to take itself out of the agreement. And there is not very much that any of the other countries can do about those sort of scenarios. So yeah, it's really, really hard to figure out one set solution. But I just want to reiterate, so the Paris Agreement had 196 parties adopting this legally binding treaty. It was 198 for the Montreal Protocol. So like, it was 100% possible. And I think we just need to talk about when it did happen, to remind people that it did happen.
Yeah.
To try and not lose faith in things like COP26 happened quite recently. And I think we can all agree that that was a bit of a shit show.
I hate COP. I just hate COP, full stop. I think it's an absolutely useless, show off.
What is this? I don't know this.
It's the United Nations Climate Change Conference.
Yeah.
And it happens every year, and all the world leaders get together. It's useless. It's honestly probably one of the most useless things I've ever... It's just talk and talk and talk and talk and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been there for the last 10 years. So
just to put this into perspective, the Paris Agreement of 2015, where that 196 different parties adopted a climate action, that was at a COP event. So that was at one of these United Nations climate conferences. Hmm. And obviously a lot of people seem to be very, very into it. And the Paris Agreement is a groundbreaking piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just taking time for different countries to adopt it into their own and to ratify it into their own law, which makes sense-ish, kind of. It's been a while since that agreement happened. But basically, there are a lot of reasons why international law, especially environmental law, takes so much time to work through. But I don't think that means we should lose hope with it. Again, we've done it before. We can do it again.
I think this is a good, this is a good story in the ultimately.
Yeah.
I think I would be surprised how many world leaders, even current world leaders, even knew about the Montreal Protocols and how it actually led to change. They might know that it happened. They might not even be aware how significantly it affected the planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
I think it's also because this sense of doomerism is a surprisingly effective weapon to do nothing, right? Because I feel the modern sense is that with the Paris Accords, it's these kinds of things happen. They're always complicated. And I feel the powerful thing about this lesson is to be able to hold people accountable to how good they have been in the past.
Right.
To be
No,
it is possible. Actually, you guys did it. We did this one time. And I know it's always going to be more complicated than that, but I do think an important factor in this complicated mess are the wins, and I think it's just harder to sell sometimes, but it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a lovely note to maybe end it on, Tom. I loved that because I did not write a nice, pretty ending to this. I left it there.
You just wrote
apparently
a few more slams on that one tweet, which is well deserved.
Thank you so much for listening to my tale of the ozone and how fixing it was pretty amazing and how we're gonna fix the issues that we currently have. We've got this. Yeah. Amazing. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Caroline. That was very useful information.
That was a great topic.
I don't say that often on this podcast, which is a weird thing to say.
Go call your congressman and tell them that snakes have the most bones. The whole saga from discovery to legal proceedings to international agreements is such a wild process for science.
Ignorant physicists to Concord to 198 different parties to here we are now.
Everyone, thank your local ignorant physicists.
Yeah.
Parenting. It's hard, but don't worry, you're not alone. Belly up to the low bar with One Bad Mother and let us remind you that fine is good enough.
They want to climb on different things. And how am I supposed to keep them both from dying?
There is a right way to do this. And if I can figure out that right way, I'm going to be a good parent. So that is not a thing.
So join us each week and let us tell you that you are doing a good job. You can listen to One Bad Mother on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is going to be surprisingly one of the most question-y questions I feel like I've asked. And so I want to start asking what y'all... You'll see. We'll start with asking what y'all know. Do either of you know how far owls can turn their heads around?
It's at least a full... Yeah.
No.
Is it a 180 or a 360?
No.
They can at least turn it all the way over.
Whoop, no.
Whoop, you know?
It's 270 is the full range.
All right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I know this. Oh. I feel like I'm going to be good at this. I don't know the answer, but I feel I'm going to be good at it because it's like extrapolated from understanding human anatomy a little bit.
Oh.
There's going to be a lot of fun anatomy stuff that I'm excited to see your insights on. So, as a paper by Krings et al. From 2017 put it, quote, rotation capability of 270 degrees is the common point of view in literature. They also say, quote, neck rotations of up to 180 degrees are also known from other birds, but a 270 degree neck rotation capability is considered outstanding.
I'm just turning my neck in the as Tom talks about this.
I thought you were looking behind you to see if like someone was coming or something. No, you were just doing a little experiment of your own.
I'm just testing my own rotation capabilities.
Well, I'm going to be asking you to do that in a second, but I will want to clarify really quickly that having dug through some of these papers, that 270 degree number is a little finicky, which is, you know, totally understandable.
It always is.
Also, it doesn't mean 270 in one direction. It means 270 total. So,
nope. It means in one direction.
Does it?
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
I'm not.
I don't believe you.
Because I was about to be so snarky and be like, look, I can move my head 180 degrees.
Yes, that's an important distinction. Yes.
That's why I'm sick. Because they say about humans, you can do a 180 rotation. Because you can do 90 either side. So you're saying one direction?
Yes.
That's bonkers. That is insane.
So most papers acknowledge and understand the issues with this. So owls... In experiments, they've absolutely been observed to go at least 180 degrees in one direction. That's been observed, like documented a lot. But you know, none of these people studying owls want to like strain or hurt the animals.
Yeah.
And of course, also researchers understand the limitations of using skeletons or dead owls. You know, there's tons of limitations to those studies. Also, it's likely that the 270 degree number is like an extreme case rather than a comfortable one.
But that means that they could do like a 540 then, is what you're saying. That's their range of motion.
That they could do a 540 Christ Air and then a grind.
They could do a 360 no scope.
And grab a mouse. I love the idea of owls doing like trick shots on mice, just like doing a puff flip. So it's likely that the 270 degree number is like an extreme case rather than like a comfortable one, but owls are all the time easily able to do over 180 degrees.
Well, it's good to know that researchers aren't like grabbing live owls' heads and just being like,
or I don't know, like trying to scare it so much that
the hand actions that went with that sound were amazing. Just put that out there.
Implied that you had done something similar too.
Well, I was just gonna do the hand gestures. I was like, this is a podcast, so I'm gonna make the mouth sounds as well.
It came through. I think it came through. So 270 degrees is like canonical in the literature, but regardless of where it actually falls in real life circumstances, the paper put it, quote, owls are known for their outstanding neck mobility. So now that we know that, the first question I want to ask is why? Like, why are owls specifically so good at neck flexibility?
Do you mean like physiologically or?
Yeah, let me rephrase it. Like another way to think of it is like, why would an owl benefit from neck flexibility?
So owls are, I think they're pretty much like top predators. So I don't think it's for, protection reasons. So I assume it's for like looking for prey, basically, is probably the best.
Nail it.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. Obviously, this is extremely complicated, and there's like a whole sea of factors. Evolution is never like A causes B, but there do seem to be a lot like this perfect storm of hunting behaviors that would imply the reasons why this is the case. So to start off first, what do you guys know about owl eyes?
They are big. Really big. So that really big pupils to let in a lot of light.
Yeah, because they're nocturnal.
Do you know anything that's different about, like, for instance, an owl's eye versus a pigeon's eye?
I don't know much about eyes, actually.
So, and I'm sure you're gonna know the implications of this when I say it, but first of all, owls have front-facing eyes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're predators, obviously.
Yeah. Front-facing eyes. So I'm sure both of you already know the implications of, like, side and front-facing eyes, but can either of you explain what that sort of, like, implies for listeners who may not know this?
So, the side eyes... tends to be for prey species, and for like looking around is that you are looking around like a wider area if you have eyes on the sides of your heads, whereas if they're forward facing, you're like, I don't have a better way of explaining this, but like you're focusing on a specific prey animal, you're chasing something.
You're gonna hear the word and you're gonna be like, I remember this word in a second.
Yeah.
Does binocular vision ring any?
Yes, that's the word.
So just like Caroline said, if you have eyes on either side of your head, like a lot of birds and other animals do, this lets you see a huge field of vision, right?
I literally cannot stop imagining you now with eyes on, like huge eyes on the side of your head, Tom. It's really disturbing me, and I can't stop thinking about it.
All right, Discord, Photoshop challenge of the week.
That's on everythingpod.com. Join our Discord.
see the terror for yourself. If each eye can roughly see 180 degrees of vision, if they're on either side of your head, you can basically see entirely around you. Ophthalmologist André Rochon Duvenu once said, quote, "A pigeon is nothing else but two eyes with wings."
No. We'll not accept this. This pigeon slander? Slander of pigeons. Pigeons are wonderful creatures.
Extremely smart. They're lovely. Very kind. Yeah.
And if you're thinking about getting a parrot one day,
get a pigeon.
What you should is get a pigeon, because that's what you really want. They're really friendly.
I'm glad we're all
pro
pigeon.
Go into the streets and just grab a pigeon and take it home with you.
We're all in agreement. Oh, never mind. Nope. Okay, spoke too soon. But that said, pigeons do have like a huge field of vision because of that. Mm-hmm. But if you have front-facing eyes, your fields of vision from both eyes overlap, which lets you see a smaller angle, but it lets you see in stereo. So you basically have 3D vision or depth perception.
Oh, depth perception. So so what you're saying, that prey animals can only see in 2D?
No, and of course, you know, that's part of the reason why...
Or they just don't have a good sense of distance.
It's not as good.
That's why they have like more acute like other senses, like hearing. So that helps
totally.
Them.
But it is also theorized that one of the reasons why birds bob their heads back and forth is to actually help with depth perception, right? By moving their eyes to different places, they can see the same thing from different perspectives, if that makes sense.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Regardless, the point is that like eye placement can help your behavior. And for owls, it's on the front to help them with finding and hunting down small animals. Now, you may be saying, okay, that makes sense, but I have front-facing eyes. And I can look over my shoulder without turning my neck 270 degrees. I can see behind myself. You know, if you've ever like driven a car and you look behind, you can see behind yourself. So.
So
why do owls need to be able to turn their neck 270 degrees, Caroline?
Because they can't move their eyes.
You fucking got it. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
I had no idea about this.
I had no idea that. That makes so much sense.
While owls have front-facing eyes, you as a human being have front-facing eyeballs.
Oh my god, they don't have eyeballs.
I found a great quote from McGill University that really sums it up. They say, quote, "You know how we have eyeballs? Well, owls don't."
What? No, what? That's crazy.
No. Oh my god, I'm going to tell so many people this at work tomorrow.
I need to know how this works.
So they have like, I guess you could call them eyeballs. So most birds have non-spherical eyes. They're sort of like flat or oblong. They're almost like pancakes.
Of course our eyeballs are like, eye structure is different in different animals. Yeah. Why did I never think about this? It's because I think about, I always think about mammals, I guess.
But, and so owl eyes in particular are often like tubular. They almost look like a mushroom kind of. It's kind of wild. And so nearly all birds have extremely low movement abilities with their eyes. So there was a study by, you want to look it up, Ella?
Yeah, I just want to see what an owl eyeball looks like. Well, it's not a ball, an owl eye oblong. Oh yeah, okay. Well, I still would assume, okay, so what Tom is saying is right. It's like the lens at the front is like the cap of the mushroom, and it goes back and becomes like a little mushroom stem. Is how I'd describe how it looks. Well, the reason it must not move then must be because they don't have the muscles that we have on either side of the eyes to like, that we use to move our eyes.
There's
they
all kinds of factors. I think also having to do with probably their skull and some other reasons. But yeah. So there's a study by Steinbach and Moni that found that owls can only move their eyes around 1.5 degrees in any direction.
Wow.
Whereas for humans, it's about 45 degrees in any direction.
I've spent so much of this topic looking behind me and turning my head.
But yeah, this is why if you've ever told a bad joke to a bird, you'll never see them. You'll see them like tilt their head all the way back because they can't roll their eyes.
Awful.
And so... based on these constraints, if you've got bird eyes that can't move, but you still want to be a predator, a bendy neck seems like the perfect solution for like directing all of your front-facing organs.
Yeah, that makes sense. So does that mean that other predator birds, because there's loads of them, they also have more rotational necks as well than prey birds generally?
I couldn't find...
just the exceptionally good ones?
Yes, correct. So I haven't seen like a big meta study of all of them, but I have heard predatory birds do often have both front-facing eyes and also the same neck rotation ability.
Yeah.
So,
feel like when I think about like a falcon or something like that, I feel like I can see that it's...
Yeah.
I remember that they turn their heads, their necks quite a lot. Okay. Interesting.
Another interesting thing is that as well as sight, some owls have a quote frontally oriented ruff that like allows them to hear better facing forward. And so that same paper by Krings et al. Put it that quote, the neck is evolved in every orienting movement of the owl towards a sensory stimulus. It's basically like one of those like desk lamp necks that lets you like point this cone of death anywhere to hunting its prey.
Cone of death.
So then the question is, how is this possible? Or maybe a better question is, why might this be difficult to do?
Because if you turn your neck so far, like any muscles that are in there are going to get twisted. Mm-hmm. Breathing apparatus are going to get twisted.
I think one of the reasons that humans can't turn their heads that far, two of the reasons, right? One is going to be like your spine and like how that is structured. And then the other will be like, I think we have like main arteries and vessels on our neck.
That's one of the biggest.
That like, if you turn them too far, they're going to get like crushed.
Yep. When it comes to sort of like what will break first in that chain of command, I think arteries is probably the weakest link there. And that's what we're going to get to in a second.
Mm.
But first thing that I want to like clarify that may seem totally obvious to biologists, but it's worth clarifying, is that owls aren't like pivoting their heads like a servo motor. They are actually like craning their neck. So if you imagine like a brontosaurus turning around to look behind itself, it's sort of like that, but just condensed. Sort of the reason I think why it's sort of like hard to see what's going on is because owls have so many like feathers on them. So it does sort of look like they're just like turning their head around like a robot. But this one paper pointed out in this really cool image that like if you see an owl with its head turned 180 degrees, that the top of its head will be slightly to the left or right of the middle because it's craning instead of twisting. Does that make sense?
Interesting.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I just had never thought to notice that. So that's another cool party trick in the book. So you can identify which way an owl is turning its head. But turning your neck that much has a lot of problems. The biggest of which being blood flow, especially considering its blood flow to a very important organ, the brain.
Woo.
As one researcher put it, quote, until now, Brain imaging specialists like me who deal with human injuries caused by trauma to arteries in the head and neck have always been puzzled as to why rapid twisting head movements did not leave thousands of owls lying dead on the forest floor from stroke.
Wow.
there's a ton of stuff going on in the neck and the head, but
right.
But I found this extremely interesting, all these artery adaptations. So to figure out why owls weren't passing out, in 2013, de Kock Mercado and Gayoud, who was that brain imaging specialist that just said that quote, studied owls that had died of natural causes. And along with performing dissections, they used dye injection and X-ray videography to basically be able to see the blood flow. And what they found was a lot of neat tricks in the neck of an owl. So the first is that, as National Geographic put it, quote, the team discovered owls have backup arteries, which offer a fresh supply of nutrients when blood vessels get closed off by rapid turning. Their arteries also swell to collect any excess blood created in the process.
Okay, that's cool. That's really interesting. So they have like lots of probably collagen in them, which means they're more elastic.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting, they look almost like deflated balloons rather than like tubes. Like they get wider, right. And they look like little sacks. They also found a really neat trick along the neck vertebrae of the owl. So vertebrae usually have two tiny holes called the transverse foramen. There's usually one on the left side and one on the right side, and they're what the arteries go through to travel up the neck to supply blood along the neck and up to the brain. They're basically like cable ties along the spine that like your arteries go through. And in humans, the cable ties are really snug. But for owls, they measured that the foramen holes were 10 times larger than the arteries inside of them.
Oh, wow.
So they had a ton of wiggle room, which is absolutely wild. And this isn't even like half of the adaptations they noticed. It's really amazing. And I really kind of got lost in the sauce of it all. But in many ways, I think that these are some of the more interesting like evolutionary adaptations we've talked about. And it's completely hidden away, right? Which is so fascinating.
They're definitely interesting. These ones are more understandable to me in a lot of ways. They're so small, like they're very subtle changes.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, so one owl was born with a mutation that meant that one of its holes, transverse foramen, was slightly bigger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was selected for. You can see how these small things would lead to like all these tiny changes that led to this larger adaptation.
I just find it amazing that I'm sure it's where your brain goes to, but my brain thinks of evolution as a very like behavioral thing on like a more macro scale. And so it is really cool to see.
Oh, really? That is very different. I'm like,
it makes perfect sense. And so the researchers made a poster visualizing everything going on that I sent to y'all. And it actually won first place in the 2012 International Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge.
Mm.
I will say, it's really dense in vocabulary, but if you're a big anatomy buff, check it out and you might get a kick out of it.
I really like it. I think it's really, it's surprisingly clear. And obviously I have like some anatomy background, but if you ignore some of the like words and use it and look at it more intuitively, which is like, there are two blood vessels, there are bigger holes.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's very clear.
I was really hoping you would get a kick out of it, Ella. And so through a combination of specialized blood vessels, specialized bones, specialized eyes, and hunting behaviors, owls are able to turn their heads and be really amazing hunters.
Mm.
And I love this story because it's such a beautiful story of like behavioral biology, the physics of optics, like vascular and skeletal anatomy, and the like evolutionary forces that like link them all together. It's like the construction of a perfect Eggs Benedict, right? It's like you got the hollandaise, the egg, the crunch. And stories of biology like that are amazing. You can like feel this story of the adaptations in this cycle of survival of the fittest.
Mm.
But, of course.
Oh, no.
I love it when there's a but. Oh, my goodness.
But, of course, as we all know, those aren't the only stories in evolutionary biology. Because evolution isn't always such an exciting story. Sometimes it reads more like a misprinted phone book or a vacuum cleaner's warranty page written in another language. And that's why this question is actually about two evolutionary stories. And to get to that second story, I'm going to ask a very similar question. Do you know which mammal has the highest neck turnability?
My brain went to some kind of monkey or ape. maybe.
Interesting. So, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, the award for, and I don't know why they have this, quote, farthest head rotation by a mammal, this is real, you can look it up, is the Tarsier. Have y'all seen what these little fellas look like?
Yes. I feel like I know. I feel like I
recognize
this.
Yeah, I'm sure you've
this.
Seen this.
Yeah.
Can you look it up and describe it for the listener?
Oh, I love these guys. They're so cute. And they have really freaky long fingers to eat termites and things out of the trees. They're great.
They have really big eyes.
So tarsiers are primates, and just like owls, they are nocturnal, and they have these huge front-facing eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so according to Guinness, quote, in the mammal kingdom, the unique spinal morphology of tarsiers makes them capable of turning their heads nearly 180 degrees in either direction.
Interesting. Wow.
But
another one?
Uh-huh. But I didn't spend hours researching the tarsier because I'm happy to let you all know that the Guinness Book of World Records is absolutely wrong here.
Ooh.
Oh, I didn't actually acknowledge that you said the Guinness Book of World Records, because the Guinness Book of World Records is a load of bullshit.
Uh-huh. I have a line right here to say, quick side note, Guinness Book of World Records, it's a sham. It costs like hundreds to thousands of dollars to get appraised by them. It's basically a way to sell people awards is what it is.
Yeah.
So maybe Big Tarsier funded this award, but regardless, Guinness Book of World Records is wrong. There is another mammal that can turn its head not just 180 degrees, but can supposedly match the owl's 270 degrees.
Oh, I don't know.
And not only does it do that, it does so by breaking something referred to as the rule of seven. Do either of you happen to know which animal this is? I'll give you a hint. We've talked about it on the show before.
A naked mole rat, a bat, a bee. No, that's not a mammal. I don't know.
So there's a really fantastic paper by Buckletz and Stepien titled Anatomical Transformation in Mammals, Developmental Origin of Aberrant Cervical Anatomy in Tree Sloths.
Oh, okay. So they have more than seven cervical vertebrae. Cervical vertebrae are the ones that attach your neck to your head.
Exactly. Oh. I was just about to ask if you remembered or if you knew what the rule of seven describes, and if you could just like restate it.
So the cervical vertebrae are the ones attached to the neck to the head, and there are seven of them in mammals.
Yes.
Everything from humans to giraffes have seven, don't they?
To whales, yeah.
Oh, nice.
As the paper describes it, quote, mammalian cervical count, that's neck bones, has been fixed at seven for more than 200 million years.
Wow.
But there are exceptions, including sloths, who have developed, quote, solutions to mechanical support of the head while inverted. The elongated neck of the genus Bradypus possesses 8 to 10 cervical vertebrae.
No way!
It is weakly muscled, and the clavicle is reduced. The neck's great mobility allows the head to rotate 270 degrees and to rest on its chest.
Oh, that's so cute.
It is very sweet. But
no!
What's even wilder is they also looked at the genus Colopus, which it's an entirely different family of sloth. It's a two-toed sloth instead of a three-toed sloth.
Right.
And they say, quote, in contrast, the short neck of Colopus possesses 5 to 8 cervical vertebrae.
Oh.
It is thickly muscled with a robust clavicle. It has limited flexibility and is generally held in an extended position. So it broke the rule of seven in the other direction also, right? Again,
right.
To put it into perspective, whales, humans, bats, giraffes, dogs, even the tarsier all have 7 neck vertebrae. Meanwhile, 2 different sloths have, quote, broken the 7 cervical vertebrae barrier independently and in opposite direction.
That's so funny.
Right, that is very,
that's
very
bizarre.
Strange.
And the wild thing is, what caused this rule-breaking adaptation? And they say it is because, quote, it is selectively advantageous to animals with inverted posture. So basically, just from hanging around. It does raise a question, why do sloths hang then? Do either of you guys happen to know offhand?
Why sloths hang, like from trees and stuff?
Yeah.
It's comfy.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not entirely... one of the theories is energy conservation. But also, according to the Sloth Conservation Foundation, Quote, sloths need to eat the young, tender leaves that grow on the outer tips of branches because they are easier to digest and often have a lower toxin content.
I love sloths so much.
In order to reach these new leaves, sloths frequently have to hang inverted. So it's because they got gentle tummies.
Of course, when you see like a classic image of a sloth in your mind, it's like they're hanging upside down, their necks are just completely limp.
Yeah.
And just so cute.
But what continues to be so strange is that, like, hanging upside down raises so many more questions that I feel like it answers. I found another paper from Sangaris, Bratz et al. That said, quote, tree sloths have low muscle mass, but they are capable of suspending themselves underneath tree branches for extended periods of time, a behavior that requires great strength. This paradox of having both high strength and endurance is difficult to reconcile by our current understanding of the physiological properties of mammalian skeletal muscle.
Wow.
Sloths are an anomaly.
Truly, and, you know, and I don't know if you guys remember, they came up in the thermal biology episode because they are one of the only mammals that is occasionally cold-blooded for, they flicker back and forth for seemingly no reason, just like to conserve energy, I suppose. And so, like, it's really tempting to just, like, throw your hands in the air and just be like, sloths are weird, which is what an author of a different paper on sloths did from 2014 when they said, quote, nothing that sloths do is normal. But the primary author of that same paper, Rebecca Cliff, had a slightly different perspective. She said, quote, the fact that sloth sloths have been on this planet for almost 64 million years shows that they have a winning strategy. As she goes on, the sloth life is certainly not the lowest form of existence, but as strategic as that of any other animal.
Aww.
And that's what I think the lesson is from this head-turning question. Now that we've heard from both the owl and the sloth, we have two animals that can turn their heads 270 degrees. One, because of this, like, culmination of hunting adaptations, and one that's broken evolutionary rules so that it can hang upside down and eat leaves easier. and they both work, right? I think evolution and the idea of, like, survival of the fittest is so often portrayed as, like, this, like, story of, like, predator and prey that, like, builds on itself and has this, like, mm-hmm. clever ending, this, like, payoff. But just as often, evolution and survival of the fittest is about, at its base, it's about, like, mutations and oddities that might not make sense or might not have a clear answer or might be strange, but they're both valid and they're both deserving of our attention.
I mean, there are so many examples of evolution where
yeah,
there's been a trade-off between something that might be slightly beneficial for something that was hugely not beneficial.
Yeah.
And like that animal is constantly battling with the problems of that. You know?
You think about like mating rituals and stuff like that, right? Like that totally flies in the face of this like predator prey. It's like, no, I just want to have bigger feathers actually. And that's what I'm going to evolve.
I want prettier feathers so I can show off to my mate. Please,
and sometimes you want to hang upside down so your tummy doesn't hurt so bad so you can eat better leaves. And, and they're both totally valid. And
I
so
want that.
The moral of the question is there's more than one way to turn heads in the animal kingdom.
Oh, awful.
That's that. Evolution's weird.
Wonderful, Tom. Lovely.
Thank you, Tom.
I don't have any large sweeping sentiment because this is just quite nice.
Do you want to repeat that moral then? So it doesn't seem like I said it.
Yeah, okay. So, no.
Yeah, that's fair.
This week on Bullseye, Tom Hanks, as you've never heard him before. Mad.
You moron. Thank you for the use of the turn signal. Way to use your blinker, idiot.
That's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
So today, we're going to talk about the Eurovision Song Contest.
Woo!
We can get really into this. Really into this stuff. What is y'all's familiarity? How do you say this, Tom?
I practice 10 times in the mirror every morning.
What's y'all's familiarity Is that how you say it?
There it
What's
is.
Familiarity?
With familiarity.
Familiarity. I said too many L's. Are you familiar with the Eurovision Song Contest?
Yes. I watch it every year.
Really?
Every
I have
year.
No concept of how big it is. I feel like every like 3 years or so, it breaks into the U.S. cultural conscious. Mm-hmm.
If you're on Tumblr, then it will break into the U.S. cultural conference every year. But
yeah.
And I feel like if I do see clips from it, I might not even like process it's from Eurovision necessarily, or like I just like think it like pops up. I don't. I'm certainly not like counting down the days or anything like that. Yeah. Or like watching it live.
I'm literally counting the days down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I literally know. I will like make sure I'm free on the weekend that Eurovision is on, so that I'm. Or at a Eurovision based party.
Yes, yeah.
How many goodness. Do we know how many days?
It's on the third weekend of May, this next one.
Okay.
It's always on the second or third weekend of May, which is great, which is useful for booking hotels if you want to go and see Eurovision. I know because I tried to book for this year, and by the time I'd gotten there, all of the hotels in this city that had been announced, which we'll get into, had already gone. It's bonkers.
Wow. Okay.
I
need to learn so much.
Okay, so the Eurovision Song Contest is an annual international songwriting competition featuring entrants from mostly European countries. Hmm. This includes emotionally wrought ballads, over-the-top pop numbers, and powerful political statements. Eurovision is a cultural powerhouse, and we have a lot to talk about. But first, where did it start? And where is it now?
Ooh.
So the first Eurovision
started, it was around the same time as like the Olympics, right? Like in Athens, right?
Yeah. Was, like, it was like
it all come together.
But like, BC kind of.
Yeah.
So the first Eurovision was held in 1956 in Switzerland.
Oh wow!
So it's been going for quite a while, and seven nations competed in the original: the Netherlands, Switzerland, Belgium, Germany, France, Luxembourg, and Italy.
Fun.
Okay.
Cute. It was very formal. People were dressed up in tuxedos and ball gowns.
Wow. No way!
Yeah. The music was done by a live orchestra.
Wow!
But some of the music that was featured was pretty modern for its time, like Freddie Quinn's So geht das jede Nacht, which has early rock and roll stylings. And that's our first clip, Tom.
No way!
Am Donnerstag gehst du mit Tommy aus, so geht das jede Nacht.
Ooh.
So geht das jede Nacht.
Oh, I love it.
That rules.
It's great. This really cute, like, little rock and roll bop around the time that you would have heard those very early rock tunes, like pre-Elvis.
Yeah.
And you may be able to tell from this that people generally perform their songs in their own language. That was Germany.
That's a great point, yeah.
But this isn't a rule. This wasn't a rule until 1966. So in 1965, the Swedish entry performed in English, which received loads of complaints.
Wow.
So the follow... yeah.
You know, like, if this was an American-run context, I feel like it would be like, and then the rule was you had to be in English. But now you're saying the rule is you have to be in your native language. Yeah.
Which really shows a kind of level of derision towards Britain a lot of the time.
Oh, I was going to say a love of unity for or appreciation for different cultures, but no, it's just...
No, it is. That is the moral of Eurovision. It's supposed to be about, like, showing cultures, and that is part of why they wanted people to perform in their own language. But so in 1965, the Swedish entry performed in English, got loads of complaints. So the following year, they restricted songs to only the official language of their country.
That's so wild that they would make that restriction. I love it, but that's cool.
This rule was abolished in 1973, reinstated again in 1977, and abolished again in 1999.
What?
Yeah.
So is it presently it's abolished?
You can do whatever you want, yeah.
Okay. In some ways, that makes sense to have the freedom too, but that's really funny that it changed so much.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
I would say there's like around a 50-50 split of songs in English versus other languages now. And depending on how like the current landscape of the world is, you start to see more in their own language.
Yeah.
So Eurovision started with these seven countries, but now over 40 countries compete every year.
Wow.
And the country that wins the competition will host it the next year.
Mm.
So only 24 to 26 countries make it to the grand final, so they have these like knockout semi-finals beforehand.
What?
Yeah,
which are typically done by like a jury vote.
Yeah, it's the same song, I assume, right?
Yeah, it's the same song. You'll take that through multiple rounds because you have to like your country's entrant as well. So they'll have a home competition before sending you to the like world stage.
Can I say, I think it's so cool that it's a songwriting competition. I feel like all the U.S. music competitions are like, you know, it's just covers of other songs. And it's, you know, like American Idol, right? It's just like a singing competition, quote unquote, as opposed to...
Yeah.
The songwriting is so much involved in that. And it's such a deep thing. That's really cool.
That's a really good point, because often I would say the live performances in Eurovision, the voices aren't as good as or like a strong, but they... The jury votes at least go on things like lyrics and music.
Yeah.
Like the, and a little bit on the performance as well.
Sure.
So you get these knockout semifinals, but since 1999, four countries have automatically qualified for the grand finals.
Huh?
These are Germany, Spain, France, and the UK. And in 2011, Italy was included, and together they are called the Big Five. And this is because they give the largest monetary contribution to the European Broadcasting Union. As you can imagine, not everyone loves this. And Turkey actually withdrew in protest over this in 2013.
Whoa!
But Turkey withdrew in protest over so many things, so I don't even think that's very... Voting for songs in Eurovision has changed drastically over the course of its history. So originally this was done in secret by a jury. You didn't even see the points, or like you didn't see the kind of where who had chosen things and where they went to. Quickly you started to see the points totaled and tallied up. And then from 1998, televoting by the public was introduced.
Wow, I didn't realise it was so recently.
Yeah, it wasn't until like 3 or 4 years after that that it actually became mandatory. So for a few years, a bunch of countries didn't have the televoting.
Yeah.
In 2009, though, the jury was reintroduced alongside the public vote to lessen the impact of political voting.
Wow.
I'm sorry. Just really quickly, did Eurovision just... reinvent the like bicameral legislature where you have like a public vote but then also like a senatorial vote?
Oh yeah, they're doing what America's doing. This law gets deeper, Tom. This is one of the things.
Also, I'm still picturing the like ballrooms where I'm sure like the 10 old men with beards go off into a corner and they judge the song, and now it's like a whole other thing.
I would say if you want to imagine the stylings of whatever era we're talking about, just imagine what pop culture was like at the time, and that's probably a good way to like envision it.
It follows pop culture really strongly, that's so cool. Yeah,
but basically the jury was reinstated to lessen the impact of political voting, and this is one of the things I find exceptionally fascinating about Eurovision. It's not openly political. In fact, there are rules against that, but there is a very strong undercurrent of politics in songwriting, voting, and broadcasting. In fact, several academic papers have been written about how... about how countries form cliques or voting blocks, which influences the outcome of the competition. An extensive post on the website Toward Data Science uses voting data from the past 20 years to identify these voting blocks. And what they found is that public voting is pretty strongly geographically linked. So Northern Europe, the Scandinavian Slavic countries, tend to vote similarly and more likely to vote for each other. The Northern Balkan countries, like Hungary, Romania, and Siberia, are grouped in the same way. The Southern Balkan countries, Greece, Malta, Bulgaria, grouped. But Western European countries, like the Big Five, don't tend to block vote. And this is probably... because they are less culturally and politically involved with one another.
Right.
And these voting blocks do affect overall rankings.
It was, for a moment, I blanked out and we were talking about, like, voting blocks, and I was seeing the countries, and then I had to remember that these voting blocks were for Eurovision. Yeah. that is what is amazing.
Well, that's the thing. The real-life political situations of Europe are reflected in Eurovision, and it has always been that way. But from what this article told me, it doesn't influence the actual winner of the competition, because people still tend to vote for overall for the song they like the most.
That's great to know.
It is good to know. But I think British people would be unhappy to hear this, because we have a very long-standing beef with Eurovision. We have won Eurovision 5 times in its history. Almost 70-year history now.
Especially considering you get an automatic in to the semifinals.
Yeah. But the last time we won was in 1997.
Wild. I'm sorry for laughing.
And this next this next clip is my favorite British winner, Box Fizz, oh with God. Making Your Mind Up in 1981.
Oh, I love this song.
Just for reference, thanks, this band looks like if each member of the Wiggles fucked a member of ABBA.
And it's not even close to the most ridiculous outfits you will see on Eurovision. So, I love that song.
Yeah.
Listen, I only heard like a 10-second clip there, but like...
It was the early 80s.
It feels like a parody, a modern parody of like that era of Europe. They're literally like swinging their arms and they're like, you know, you gotta bop. And it's... I'm sorry, this is so great.
It's so interesting seeing someone who's not been exposed to Eurovision be exposed to it first time or properly. But basically, I mean, that was 1981. The last one was 1997. But since then, something happened. We have come in dead last place 5 times. Five times since 2013, receiving no points at all 2 of those times.
What?
Before 1997, we were always in the top 10. And we have been in the bottom quarter all but twice since 2003. Until last year, which I will get into.
That's so interesting. Okay, I'm invested now. I'm really invested. I would not have guessed that at all. Especially since you guys get the automatic in.
I mean, Europe do generally dislike Britain. And the British love to complain that it's this politics that is the reason we've done so badly for the last 20 years. And there definitely are elements of politics in this, because there are in everything in Eurovision. But sure. The truth is, we just don't put enough effort in.
Fully.
There is huge snobbery against Eurovision in the UK, and I think that's to do with the music landscape of Britain, where we've always been world leaders in like music and producing music, so look down on Eurovision in a lot of ways.
That's really
interesting.
And
we just don't send good acts. That's my kind of analysis of it, at least.
Huh.
So we really don't send good acts. Case in point, this is our 2007 entry, Scooch with Flying the Flag.
I forgot about this.
You guys need to let me make some up and see if I guess correctly, because I could have come up with Scooch by Flying the Flag or whatever it was.
This is so bad.
Flying the Flag by Scooch.
Coming up is... Tea Time by Bumbledoof. All right, here we go.
Oh, it's so horrible.
This is like the first Eurovision that I remember being a little kid. So this is like in my head forever.
Oh,
there you go.
God.
It's so bad.
Oh, wow.
I really, really recommend watching the video for this if you're listening. It's truly hideous. It's really, really bad.
They're all dressed in flight attendant uniforms. They've got luggage and they're doing like airplane signs.
Why did we do that?
I hate it, but I'm also now so invested in whatever train wreck could happen at the next Eurovision. Knowing that I can either witness an amazing bop or...
Yeah, that is one of the amazing things about Eurovision.
Yeah.
It's funny what is convincing me. It is like the drama of losing and also the... Because listen, even the other one that I was laughing at was at least a song. feels like a commercial.
Yeah, it's like a kid's, like made for a kid show or something.
Yeah.
One of the comments under this video, which really says it all, I think, nobody hates the British entry more than the British.
It's so true.
I'm going to bring the tone down a little bit here, because politics doesn't just affect voting. It bleeds into all aspects of the show, from the real political landscape of Europe. For example, Ukraine's 2016 entry, 1944, which is sung in Ukrainian, has lyrics referencing the deportation of the Crimean Tartars during 1944, which the Russian delegation claimed had a greater political meaning, as Russia had recently annexed Crimea, and it probably did. Russia didn't compete the next year because their entrant couldn't legally enter the Ukraine because they'd broken Ukrainian law by entering Crimea through Russia previously.
Wow.
Ooh.
Similarly, Russia was banned from competing in 2022 due to the invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Away from Russia, though, is Israel began competing in Eurovision in 1973, which, of course, would have its fair share of controversy. Arab states that broadcast Eurovision, which includes some that compete, like Morocco, just skip Israel's entry.
Ooh. Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But this has its own issue because Israel does win sometimes.
Yeah.
So they're skipping the winning entry and then missing quite a lot of the rest of the competition. So 2019 Eurovision was held in Tel Aviv, which led to mass boycotts of Eurovision. It goes on. So the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is an ethnic and territorial conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Which is going has been going on consistently at some level since 1988. As a result, there is usually some disagreement between these countries almost every year at Eurovision. So Armenia did not compete in 2012 after Azerbaijan won in 2011. Azerbaijan has been accused also of censoring Armenia's performances. There were reports that the Azerbaijani government interrogated citizens who voted for Armenia in 2009.
No, God, this runs so deep.
I keep forgetting we're talking about Eurovision.
It's crazy.
I knew it ran deep. I didn't know it ran that deep. Wow.
Yeah, and it genuinely gets deeper. So towards the end of the Cold War, Yugoslavia broke up. That consisted of countries Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia, Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Slovenia. And this whole breakup led to the Bosnian War, which ran from 1992 to 1995. So in 1993, Bosnia and Herzegovina had their first ever entrant, Muhammed Fazlajic. This is him speaking about trying to get out of the country for Eurovision in an article for the BBC. It was in the middle of the night and it was very muddy because it'd been snowing so much and I started running and my shoes got stuck. I couldn't stop. People were shooting, so I kept going without shoes 5-6 hours. It was only when we got to the top of the Igman, the mountain that overlooks Sarajevo, and was the only way out of the siege, that someone gave me a new pair of shoes.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
Mohammed also talks about the song he performed. He says, "It's about me sending my love to a woman who's a refugee outside the country, telling her we won't give up." His girlfriend, who is now his wife, was living outside the siege at the time. "It's a bit bleak compared to your average Eurovision entry, isn't it?" the reporter asks. "We'd been in siege for 300 days, he replies. "What else would we sing about?"
Yeah.
Aww.
Yeah, wow.
Literally risked his life to get to Eurovision and then sang a song about the siege of his country. He's very... I think he won for that performance as well.
What I keep underestimating is because it has been on so long, it has covered such a span of history.
Yeah.
It embedded in it are these references and fragments of, it's almost like an organic version of We Didn't Start the Fire in a way, right? It's like a musical record of history in some ways, which is wild. I had never considered that aspect of it.
Even wilder, this is one of the most amazing things I've heard. Okay. The 1974 Portugal entry, "I Depois do Adeus," acted as a secret signal to launch the Carnation Revolution, which was a leftist military coup that overthrew the authoritarian Estado Novo regime at the time.
What?
So they performed that in Eurovision and it triggered a military coup.
Oh my God. Oh my God. What? What?
What year was this?
1974.
Wow.
it's wild. So wild. So the final bit on politics that I'm going to get into is about LGBT stuff. So Eurovision has a huge dedicated LGBT plus fan base, myself included, because in many ways it is incredibly gay.
It really is.
It's often very camp and over the top, colourful and fun, and it brings people together. So in 2014, drag queen Conchita Wurst won the competition with "Rise Like a Phoenix."
That's so good. "Today, from the fading
light of life, out of the ashes, seeking rather than vengeance, red Retribution.
These runs, these melodies. Good. Wow.
Exceptional. I think that's an exceptional song.
Can I say
song.
Really quickly, Ella, thank you so much for curating this playlist that has like individual timestamps. Each one is like precisely what this is. Thank you.
No worries. So yeah, Conchita is a drag queen and people loved this performance, but not every country in Europe is so accepting of this kind of thing. Russia was very critical of Conchita winning, for example. The stage performance for Finland's 2013 entry showed a same-sex kiss as a statement against Finland's ban on gay marriage. And Turkey made the decision not to broadcast the competition at all over this. The Greek media were also really critical. And China is no longer allowed to broadcast Eurovision, according to the European Broadcasting Union, because they heavily censor these LGBT mentions or performances. And that's all I'm going to say about politics for now.
Can I just say really quick, it's so interesting, especially to hear the history of it all, because I feel like often people are like, things are so like political these days. And then to see this history of like, no, it's art, so it's always going to be political, but it's always been a political thing throughout all these years. And so
Totally right. And when I was reading the articles about this, they made a point of it too, saying that people complain that Eurovision is too political now. It's always been political, like it's from its inception. And it's when you bring European countries together like that, and it's of course it's going to be.
Yeah.
But I really do find it so wonderfully fascinating that Eurovision is like a microcosm of broader complex geopolitics in Europe. I find that very interesting. But I don't want to finish on politics because it doesn't feel right to me. So we're going to close this section out by listening to some clips of my favourite entries and hearing a little bit about them. So they feature a range of quality from songs I find genuinely good to songs I think are hilarious to songs which literally launched careers.
Wow.
Like this first one, which is Switzerland's 1988 entry, Ne partez pas sans moi by Celine Dion.
What? Hey, I know that name. No fucking way. What? I know there's a theme in a lot of it's just like a big, like, you know, I guess it makes sense because you are sort of like representing your nation. There's like a power to a lot of these that feels very
There's a lot of ballads. Eurovision is very known for its powerful ballads.
And it's also like what we should be doing is replacing the national anthem every year with these is what I'm feeling personally.
Because
like these I can agree with slap that. And also,
not the British entries.
maybe that would embarrass us enough to get our shit together and actually produce something good.
That would be so good. So Celine Dion won for Switzerland that year, and she was relatively unknown before that. This is like one of the things that launched her career. Next up is Greece's 2013 entry, Alcohol is Free. First bit in where the drop is, because I love it. The chorus basically just goes, alcohol, alcohol, alcohol is free. Hey, alcohol, alcohol.
Wow.
Not only is this a wicked fun bop, it also contains loads of metaphors about Greece's debt crisis at the time.
No fucking way.
Wow.
Which is one of the reasons it's called alcohol is free, because they're saying everything is expensive, but alcohol is cheap.
It's amazing, these little time capsules of like what is happening in all these years, and also there are bops.
Yeah, so good. That only came sixth, but I really love that song. The next is Finland's 2006 entry, and this is Lordi with Hard Rock Hallelujah. After it's played, Tom, you probably have to describe what you're seeing.
I do.
Rock Hallelujah! What's more? What's more? Hard Rock Hallelujah! Go on!
Everyone looks like, I don't know, like if H.R. Giger designed World of Warcraft characters, flayed skin and like huge jackets and like horns and skull faces. And some of them are like the one person has like these like big wings that are spanning out. At first I was like,
yeah, they have crazy prostheses on for this and loads of pyrotechnics going on. And yeah, so this Finland won this year with this song.
Really?
I think probably just because it was so crazy different.
Yeah.
But Finland often do send like a rock entry.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
And they did. And yeah, people love this
was
song.
Was it still the rule that they could only have like six people on the stage in 2006? Because I know that's currently a rule.
I should have said that. That's still a rule.
Okay.
You can only have, it might be five actually.
Oh, it might be five. I can't remember. And also you're not allowed like any children or anything. Like you have to all be adults to be on stage at Eurovision, which is,
that's fair.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no more than six performers on the stage. A song can't be more than 3 minutes in length.
Really?
You also have to have the person singing.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, because they used to have really crazy long songs and it got ridiculous.
Yeah, that's smart, yeah.
Also, the person who is performing has to be on the stage. And sometimes what countries do is they have the person singing if they're, like, standing in the background in shadow while the someone pretends to sing the song at the front. It's really
like
funny.
Like, literally, like, singing in the rain. Like, they have the person hiding in the... That's so funny.
Yeah.
Wow. Judging that.
So one of my favourite songs to ever come out of Eurovision is Iceland's 2020 entry. This is Dadiog Gagnamagnid with Think About Things.
Yes! I love this song. I love this song so much.
Bound together then and forever, and I could never let you go, baby.
What?
I can't wait to know.
Yeah.
What do you think about things? Believe it, I will always be there, so you can tell me anything and I'll listen.
This might be my favorite so far. Holy shit.
It's so good.
Yeah. really, really good song.
That is a slap and a half. That rules. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Dadiog Gagnamagnid, which is so hard to say, are a really, really good band. Sometimes, actually very often, countries will send musicians that are well respected. Mm-hmm. Britain doesn't do that. I went back and listened to their early album, and it's really good. So I unironically love them. I think they're really good. Now, the most iconic song to ever come out of Eurovision was Sweden's 1974 entry, and this needs no introduction. Take it away, Tom.
Do I know it?
Yes, you do. There's no way you don't know it.
Oh!
It's almost repeating
no
itself.
No fucking way!
What?
Hello.
This is, of course, ABBA with Waterloo.
This whole set list was curated for your enjoyment, and so maybe that's why, but it also feels I've never been more radicalized towards Eurovision than having gone through these songs.
When you said earlier about Bucks Fizz looking like Waterloo and whoever ABBA and the Wiggles combined, I was like, oh, he knows that ABBA was launched by Eurovision then.
You didn't know this?
I did. I guess I'm a bad ABBA fan. Wow.
I think they were a band before this, but not for very long before this.
But it did launch their career because
this
Eurovision can do that for people. And of course Sweden won with this entry. And I think Sweden probably has the most wins out of any country. They win all the time because they always send such good.
Yeah. They sent ABBA a few times to
did
go
they?
And perform. Yeah, yeah.
So my final song in the list.
Wow.
Was the UK's entry last year?
Oh yeah.
The UK's entry this year. No, I wrote this way because it's 2023. My final song is the UK's entry from last year. This is Sam Ryder with Spaceman.
But I'm only human, and I'm drifting in the dark. I'm up in space, up in space.
It also feels very UK. I can hear the like Elton John in it all, and it's really
It was compared to that as well. I love this song for a number of reasons. First of all, I like it as a song.
Yeah.
but also Sam was found through TikTok.
Was he?
No fucking way. No fucking...
Yeah. He started making, doing like covers of bands in his shed during lockdown. And he got pretty popular through that. And he now has like 44 million followers. Yeah. But even before that, he was pretty big on TikTok and that's how they found him. And it just shows how Eurovision changes with the times.
Yeah, yeah. From ballrooms with everyone wearing suits and ties and an orchestra performing it to a guy in a TikTok show.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Spaceman came second, which is the highest the UK's come in over 20 years.
Such a long time. It was so good.
And it shows people in the UK that we cannot blame politics for losing anymore.
Yeah.
People really love this song and they love Sam Ryder. So it just shows if we make the effort, then it will be, you know, accepted. It does help that he had a big following on TikTok.
And also, he was such a nice guy. And I think he did so well when he did really like interviews with people. Like, everybody seemed to really like him. He did very well.
And finally, about this song and this year, the UK was beaten by Ukraine, which the public... I'm not going to make a comment on that. The song, I don't think it was good as a lot of the songs at Eurovision that year. It seems that the public pulled behind to vote for them as a show of solidarity, which means that next year, Ukraine should be hosting Eurovision, which means that this year... Ukraine should be hosting Eurovision, but they are unable to due to the ongoing situation there. So obviously that's horrible, but that means, guess what that means?
Nope.
The UK is hosting Eurovision, which means that I get to go to Eurovision for the first time in my life, if I could get tickets. I am so excited.
I can't believe you'll get to watch you all lose in the from the front row.
That's absolutely fine. I don't care.
It's going to be a solid nil point for us, and that's going to be fine.
Wow. No,
I don't have an outro for this. That's Eurovision, baby.
Woo!
That's the past and the present and the future Eurovision. I
love it so much. Oh my God.
I did not think I was going to be this sold on it. I mean, in some ways, it makes perfect sense. I love music and I love songwriting, but I guess I feel like I never understood the story of it all. And it's really great to have been taken on this journey through time and through history and through politics. I'm going to be watching Eurovision this year. I guess this will be my inaugural.
I hope you do. I hope you do.
We're going to have to do like a bonus thing of like just us chatting about Eurovision.
Our debrief.
That would be great. Let's bonus content, watching Eurovision. We'll just chatting about
it. We can share our favourite songs. We can share who we voted for.
I'm definitely not going to live watch it with you because I'll be at Eurovision.
Yeah, we'll be
valid.
Well, so you'll probably like call us just to brag and be like, sorry, I can't hear you over... all the Eurovision happening. That's amazing. It's just so amazing that it is all around music and songwriting. It warms my heart that, like, you know, there's obviously a lot going on and there's politics in this all, but that's the nature of art, and it makes me happy that things like this can still be going so strong for so long and still be so powerful and so important. It's rad. It's super cool.
Yes, it is. Both rad and...
I mean, it's no American Idol, but like, it's still pretty good.
Review corner. No fanfare today.
No,
sorry, whoever's review it is. I love you.
No, you gotta give it your Eurovision all.
This is why no one votes for us, Ella.
12 points to review corner. Woo! That's a Eurovision reference that you won't get.
Ella put on all this like skull makeup and has this huge, these big wings and horns coming out. It's amazing. Great job. Great performance.
Great job.
Great job. This review comes from Mr. X2051 from Apple Podcasts, and they go, feel smarter and have fun. I picked this because, so they go, okay, I get it. You see a 90-minute episode and are second-guessing this pod your smart friend recommended. Don't sweat it. Ella, Tom, and Caroline each tackle one science topic, one science question, and a miscellaneous topic every episode, so it's easy to take it one 30-minute block at a time and remember what was covered in the wrap-up at the end. These charming dorks break down biology, chemistry, physics, psychology, and more into fun conversations about nail polish, cosmic rays, and cute animals. come feel a little smarter with these unapologetically enthusiastic nerds.
Aww, thank you so much.
We are. I'm totally happy to be called a dork and a nerd. We are. Yeah.
Unapologetic. I refuse to apologize.
We should have this as like featured on our website. Like, we know it looks daunting, but it's okay.
It's all right.
Now, hold on.
Great review. That's like a put it on the box.
Yeah,
review.
Yeah, thank you. Love that.
You got it. You nailed it.
Are there any plugs or shout outs?
Yeah, let's make some 2023 predictions. Everyone, go check out my 5-hour long video on YouTube that's deconstructing how candles work.
Perfect. Love it. As if Hank Green hasn't done that already. We're gonna...
Well, that's the problem. He hasn't spent 5 solid hours on it. That's the real...
That's true. That's true.
We're finally gonna get it.
Go and check
out... It has a million views already. Whoa!
Whoa!
Yeah, go and check out my video about breaking down Winx Fate Saga, the Netflix teen series about magic. that no one has watched. Thank you.
You think I have the motivation in 2023 to make a YouTube video?
Sorry,
absolutely.
I'm so sorry.
Fucking not.
No, yeah, no. Guys, everyone, please vote for Caroline for PM. I'm sorry. I guess we should say that. Or maybe are we not allowed to endorse a candidate?
Make me number 6 in 12 months, baby. I know we haven't had number... What is it? What are we on, number 4?
We will have by the time this episode drops.
Yeah. I reckon I'll be good at it.
Tom, where can you find us?
Well, you can find all these amazing things that we've definitely done at letslearneverythingpod.com. Each of us individually. Caroline, the bug, everywhere. Me, Tom Lomperson, everywhere. Ella, at Ella Harbour on Twitter. And at Dr. Big Science Energy on TikTok.
Amazing. Also, quick question for the Discord.
Ooh.
Should I change my username on TikTok to at Ella Hover to make this bit part of the show easier?
Just
let me know.
Honestly, not for anybody else.
Oh my god. Let us know your favorite things that have happened so far in this year. I don't know what you're looking forward to.
Your 2023 predictions.
Oh,
over
also
the Discord server.
Share your Eurovision faves, of course.
Yes.
And who you're hyped
oh
for.
Oh my god, yeah.
Okay, so this episode, we learnt that getting the ozone fixed was a fucking miracle and we can do it again. I believe in us. We learned that owls can't move their fucking eyes. I'm sorry, what? And we also learned that in 1974, Eurovision began a coup in one country.
Portugal.
Join us next time, where we will learn...
Everything! Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast, hosted and produced by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper, with editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum. I cannot wait to tell people about the fact that Al's eyes can't be...
Right!
I'm so glad you figured that out, Caroline, by, like, literally doing it yourself. That was amazing.
I was like, why can I look behind? Why? What?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just turned my shoulder instead of using my apparently advanced eyeball features.
I was literally, like, doing the exact same thing of, like, fully being like, I could do this. And Tom was like, you can look behind you without your head going behind you. It's like, oh, I can.
Yeah. You're right. This whole time I've been spinning around to do it.
Yeah.